from the Creepy Crawly studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another What's That Thing episode of Chemical Free Horticultural Hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. Have you had problems with, quote, caterpillars that weren't bothered by BT? I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll tell you how to identify the look-alike sawfly and how to handle that nasty little plant muncher. Otherwise, it's a fabulous phone call show, cats and kittens. Yes, we will take your telecommunicating questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and hauntingly hot habaneros. So keep your ears right here, because it's all coming up faster than you saying bye-bye sawfly right after this.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at WDIY.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the well-manicured studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another Turf War Hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's In the News, we present a story by Becky Little, a freelance writer based in Washington, D.C. And I quote, when spring rolls around in the Northern Hemisphere, so do conversations about no-mow May. The idea is for homeowners to forgo mowing, allowing otherwise hidden flowers to bloom in your lawn, increasing your yard's biodiversity, and providing food for pollinators like native bees. However, scientists have increasingly questioned whether this trend, which began in the UK, is comparable with US lawns. No Mow May started in 2018 as a campaign by the UK organization Plant Life. The group originally coined the slogan to encourage local UK councils to manage green spaces more like traditional hay meadows, to increase biodiversity, according to Cheryl Shuttleworth, a botanical advisor for Plant Life. In the UK, she says, people's lawns are often kind of relic grasslands, and letting them grow can reveal native flowers they didn't know they had in their lawn. Those flowers provide nectar and pollen for native bees and other local pollinators that evolved alongside these plants. No Mow May caught on in the United States around 2020 when the city of Appleton, Wisconsin started encouraging residents to participate. Soon, more than 30 U.S. cities had adopted No Mow May initiatives, and many individual households had become interested in practicing it. But at the same time, scientists began to question whether this was the right strategy for U.S. lawns. The United States has more varied climates compared to the U.K., meaning that flowers bloom at very different times across the country. In addition, the country's history of colonization means that a lot of the plants in U.S. lawns, including the grasses themselves, are non-native species. These non-native plants don't necessarily provide good support for native pollinators. In 2024, Appleton announced that it was dropping No Mow May in favor of Slow Mow Summer. The city now encourages residents to raise their lawnmowers' blades to 4 inches and wait to mow until the grass reaches 6 inches. slower or less frequent mowing does have scientific support. In 2018, the journal Biological Conservation published a study in which researchers mowed Massachusetts lawns at different intervals between May and September. They were surprised to find that lawns mowed every 2 weeks yielded more pollinators than lawns mowed every week or every 3 weeks. The theory is that this is because 2 weeks was long enough for flowers to sprout, but at 3 weeks, the grass length made it harder for pollinators to get to any flowers. The scientific consensus is to advise U.S. homeowners to choose slow mowing, and it can be their gateway into thinking about other ways of managing their lawn. As I have mentioned on the show many times, there is a long tradition of planting early blooming spring bulbs deliberately into lawns in Europe. The tiny bulbs are up and flowering long before the lawn starts to grow and are then dispatched by the first mowing. And they still return year after year.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I came upon the best insect story, identifying and figuring out what it is, because it turned up once in my garden and I had no idea, and neither would anybody else unless they know what they were looking at. We will teach you about the mysterious sawfly, which is not a fly and it's not a caterpillar, even though it looks like one. It's weird, and I'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. Mac, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Mac. Glad to talk to you. How are you doing?
I'm great, sir. And yourself?
I'm just ducky. Thanks for asking. Especially, we finally got out of our drought last week. We had pounding rain. So if I had a real ducky, he'd be real happy. Where are you, Mac?
Memphis, Tennessee.
All right. What a pleasure. What can we do you for?
My tomatoes and my fruit trees, the tomatoes, before it began to ripe, it started turning dark at the bottom.
Right.
And then it just get darker. And on the fruit trees, the same thing. It starts turning dark, and then it turns to a fungus.
Huh. What kind of fruit trees?
It's a pear tree, peach tree, and a plum tree.
Okay, the peach tree is notorious for attracting diseases. It's very difficult to grow peach trees organically or conventionally. But pear trees are supposed to be the least problematic, the least affected by disease. Are they equally affected?
Yes.
Huh.
It'll dry up, and then, like I said, it just turned to a fungus, and it runs.
Okay. What was the third tree?
The first tree was a peach tree, the second was a pear, and the third was a plum.
Plum. Okay. Okay, let's deal with the tomatoes first. How do you grow your tomatoes? How do you support them?
I grow them sometime in a pot, but most of the time just in the soil. and just the natural soil. I don't put any compost, anything around it, just the natural soil with triple 13 fertilizer.
Oh, that's it. Ding, ding, ding. That's death to
plants. Is
that
right?
Yeah. People are attracted to 10, 10, 10, but they love the equality of the numbers. The problem is there's no plant in the world that wants equal numbers of each of those nutrients. Generally, and especially for growing tomatoes, you don't need a high first number, which is nitrogen. You could use a big second number, potassium. And then the third number is like an all-around just plant nutrient. It doesn't have any specialties. But nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, you'd be looking for like a 3-6-4 or something in that ratio. Nitrogen, it's very easy to over-nitrogen a plant. But the phosphorus makes the plant stronger, improves flowering and fertility, and the potash is just good for the plant in general. So obviously you're not an organic gardener, so I would urge you to look around at local garden centers, not a farm store, not a big box store, and tell them you want a good fertilizer for fruiting plants, and they'll help you pick out the right one. Now, how big a plant are you trying to grow in a pot?
It depends on the plant. Sometimes they grow taller, and then sometimes they don't. But most of the time, they grow a fairly size. It's a tomato plant size, which is about 3 feet, 3.5 feet.
Okay. I think you're stunting the growth of your tomatoes in the pots.
Okay.
If you're going to continue in the pots, and there's no reason not to, you would stick to what are called dwarf varieties. It'll say so on the seed packet or the plant tag. These are varieties that are bred to stay mostly upright, top out at 2 to 3 feet naturally, but produce really nice, good-sized tomatoes. You know, your big heirlooms and stuff, they need to be in the ground. Now, do you have your, I guess you have your tomatoes in?
No. The weather hadn't been favorable yet.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, you know not to plant tomatoes in the same spot year after year.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So as you rotate them, what I want you to do is dig a deeper hole than you're used to digging and pull off the bottom leaves of the plant. Tomato plants don't need those leaves, but every part of the root you bury underground will grow auxiliary roots that will make the plant much healthier. And then I generally agree with don't put anything special in the planting hole, but in your case, this is a sign of calcium deficiency.
Okay.
The rotting out of the bottom of the tomatoes. Very common. So, you know, what I do is I save up my eggshells during the year, and I put the crushed shells of a dozen eggs into each planting hole. But you can, again, at a good garden center that sells organic products, you could buy a fertilizer that also has calcium. You may find that the fruiting fertilizers also have calcium. Matter of fact, there are some organic manufacturers that specifically make a tomato blend that has calcium in it.
Okay.
But you want to get that calcium down in the hole where the roots can get at it. Then you fill back the hole with the soil you dug up. And I guess I'm not going to get you to, like, spread compost around the plants or anything, am I?
I doubt it.
Okay. So instead of the chemical fertilizer you're using, now get that bag of tomato fertilizer, natural tomato fertilizer, and rough it into the soil around your plants, not touching them, going out about 6 inches. And then cover that with more soil. No matter what type it is, granulated fertilizers need to be covered with soil or compost to become active.
Okay.
You're going to be shocked at the blossom end rot you won't get. Now, how are we caring for these fruit trees? Are we doing anything to them?
No, we hadn't done anything, and I don't know if they bloomed already, and I don't know if it's too late to put something in the ground or spray them with something. I don't know.
So you don't feed them generally?
No.
Okay, that's good. How many trees do you have?
Just one each.
One each.
Well, no, there's two plums and two pears, but the peach tree, I had to take the other three down because we had a storm a few years back, and it damaged the tree, so I had to remove them, but it's only one tree left.
The peach trees are notoriously short-lived. If you get 12 to 15 years out of a peach tree, you're lucky.
Okay.
So what I want you to do, starting with the peach, I want you to get a pair of pruners and prune away a good third of the branches. Any branches that are interfering with airflow to the center of the plant, any branches that look damaged, but they need a good pruning. And then when the fruit appears, peaches must be thinned. When you got fruit out there that's the size of, say, a marble, you want to remove one-third to one-half of those marbles, and that gives the other peaches room to grow and prevents them getting crowded and picking up fungal diseases.
Okay.
The pear tree, just give a light pruning to get rid of any cross branches or branches that showed signs of disease. Same with the plum. And as the season progresses, if you see a bad piece of fruit, get it out of there.
Okay.
And throw it in the trash so that it doesn't spread. When you're ready to come around to real organic gardening, get yourself some real high quality compost and spread it around those trees because they eventually need to be fed. And compost is the best gentle natural feeding. But again, you'll find natural fertilizers that are labeled for use on fruit trees. So use those lightly and remember to cover them with dirt.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You should do better.
All right. I appreciate you. Thank you, sir.
Our pleasure, Mac. Thank you. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody out there that next week will be our final NPR show. But You Bet Your Garden will continue with new episodes every week. So send your questions and comments to ybyg@ptd.net. Write that down fast, or at least be prepared to write it down when I repeat it later. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath. A little later in the show, we will teach you about the mysterious sawfly. It's weird, and I'll tell you all about it after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls. Hillary, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks so much, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy to have you here, Hillary. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
And where is Hillary doing well?
In Fort Collins, Colorado.
Oh, okay. Range. I've spent a lot of time in Colorado. It's all different. It's all different, and it's all beautiful.
Absolutely.
Okay, and what can we do for Hillary in Colorado?
I've got a question about rabbit poop.
Go ahead.
I planted a cover crop in my garden last fall, and the rabbits ended up loving it so much, munched on it all winter long, and I've noticed that they've left behind quite a bit of dropping. And I'm wondering if it's safe to leave them in the garden, or if I should try and rake out those tiny pellets.
Don't forget, any cover crops you grow are going to attract deer and rabbits and mice and groundhogs and all of the other wonderful Disney characters that are fun when they're animated, but not so much when they're in your garden.
Exactly.
So when you first said rabbit poop, I thought you had pet rabbits.
Oh, nope.
You know, because we need their eggs for Easter, you know.
Yeah, you got that.
The good news, sorry about your cover crops. What cover crops were you using, by the way?
So I plant a winter rye.
Right.
And about late August, and then it grows in the fall, and it kind of dies back a little bit, and then it comes back in the spring. So
right.
It gives me a lot of nitrogen and organic matter when I mix it in the spring, and it dies back. And I've done it now for about 5-6 years, and this is the first year that I've really noticed a rabbit infiltration. So I'm not sure if there's just less foxes in my neighborhood now, or hawks that are taking care of the problem, but it just seems to be a lot more rabbit poop than I've ever seen out there.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised. I thought you were going to name a truly green manure, because you know, rye is a little rough on the mouth parts.
Right?
They
didn't want to eat it.
So, you know. Well, and did they take care of killing it for the season for you?
You know, it did look less grown than it usually has at this time of the year, but it's made a little bit of a comeback. So I feel like it's still going to be effective. Not as much as usual, but they definitely took it down pretty good.
Because as I mentioned recently, rye is one of those cover crops that behaves very differently in different locales and based on the exact type of rye. But had your rabbits not killed your rye, how would you have handled planting around it?
I till it in like right around now, and then I don't plant into those rows. I use them for my summer crop, so I won't be planting into those rows until about 1st of June, late May. So it just breaks down, you know, from now until then. And then I plant directly into that row.
Do you do anything to get rid of the seed heads on the rye?
You know, it doesn't get big enough to go to seed,
actually.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
You kind of have a short season where you are.
Yep.
One of the times I was in Colorado, we were staying with a couple on their farm near Cortez. And the young woman who was gallantly growing tomatoes told me that the previous year they had snow in June.
Yep, that's not uncommon here, that's for sure. And I know you always say to wait till those nights are up in the 50s until you put those warm weather crops in. And that takes definitely the first week of June for us.
I also think that some parts of Colorado, depending on where you are a little bit more like Southeast Alaska and
England, mountains.
where you might need some sort of small greenhouse apparatus to actually grow tomatoes and peppers and make sure you get some ripe ones.
Luckily, I'm on the Front Range, so I don't have to worry about that too much. We still have a short season, but not as short as those folks that live in the mountains.
Yes, exactly. I think we were 5,000 feet up just on the ranch.
Yeah, that's quite the elevation here.
People talk about the night sky, but you can't even come close until you walk out and see it.
Yeah, I agree. It's gorgeous.
All right, let's get to down to poop here. rabbit poop is one of the best natural fertilizers you can possibly have. Rabbits are herbivores, so there's no problems with any kind of disease organisms being involved as there is with animals that, eat everything.
And that's what I was mostly worried about.
Mean, your poop is full of rye.
That's fair.
It's almost like you've been raising them. The fertilizer contents, so to speak, are very balanced. It is a great balanced fertilizer. It's not heavy in nitrogen like horse or poultry manure, and it's slow release, as you know. I mean, it comes pelletized for you.
So it's a good thing then.
Yeah.
Sounds like.
Do you make compost?
I do. Yep. And I also keep chickens and I compost their poop before I put it into the garden.
Okay.
So I'm versed in all of that. So that's why I was a little worried about, the rabbit droppings going right into the garden and not being composted first.
No, it sounds like
it's better.
And it sounds like they didn't eat anything that you wanted to remain. So I would call this free fertilizer.
All right. That's a win.
So, your two choices are to mix it into your compost.
Yep.
Where it will become one with everything else and even enhance your already wonderful compost, I am sure. Yeah. Or you can side dress your plants with it. And with any kind of pelletized fertilizer, even though this was pelletized by nature, you want to cover it with a little bit of soil. If you use it around your plants. And again, especially with your short season, that'll help its soil activate. So dig a little trench, drop the pellets in, cover them with soil, and they will release their fertilizer throughout the growing season.
All right. Well, maybe I'll have the best garden yet this year.
Absolutely.
Biggest tomatoes yet.
Yeah, just, make sure you rig up something to get them some extra heat. That's your enemy. Yep. I mean, even if it's just 1 mil plastic you throw over the plants at night and remove it in the morning.
Yes, that's a great idea.
Yeah, keep warm at night.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the advice.
Oh, my pleasure. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Mike.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Doug, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am just ducky. Thank you so much for asking, Doug. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a cool, windy day in Downingtown, PA.
Okay. I'll just play the straight man. What can we do for Doug in Downingtown?
Well, I recently moved to Downingtown, and I was at a shopping center local. Some of the younger trees that they planted in the parking lot, I looked up and I noticed greenery in the middle of the winter, and I realized I think it's mistletoe. And I've never seen mistletoe in this part of the country. I've seen it in Texas, but I've not seen it in Pennsylvania before. Is it something, if it shows up in a tree on my property, do you recommend I remove it because I know mistletoe is a parasite, even though it had status in the past.
Well, it is a very unusual plant. There are not a lot of true parasites that live in the canopy of trees, but mistletoe is perhaps the best known. Now, you're driving me crazy because, you know, I've lived in Pennsylvania all my life, but I've been to Texas, I've been to Oklahoma, I've been to places that are the mistletoe capital of the U.S. And if you've done any research to make some extra money, people in these regions where there's a lot of mistletoe around, they go out into the woods with shotguns and knock it down out of the tree, and then they go sell it. So there's one of your options. When's the last time you saw real mistletoe for sale?
Well, I'm sure mistletoe does not have the same status it used to have. I mean, bringing it to an office party could probably end you up in a closed-door lecture with your human resource officer.
Heck, just calling for the party would. Yeah, it is a Christmas-associated plant because, of course, it's green in the winter and it has red berries. So green and red and alive at a time of year when everything else is dead, the mythology, the stories, the theory about this, the religious aspects, they're all over the place. Now, I'm really glad to talk to you because I haven't had a mistletoe call in a decade or more. And then they were from Oklahoma, and several of them in a row. One guy wondered if he keeps shooting the mistletoe out of the tree, is he going to ruin his supply? Is he going to get rid of it all accidentally? The other was, how do you tell people, if you're selling them this, you know, essentially a beautiful Christmas plant, that the berries are incredibly toxic? And then other people wanted to know what I believe is your question. Is this killing my plant? So now you don't have any in your trees yet.
No, sir. I noticed it in a department store shopping mall.
Huh. When you sent the pictures, did you include the base of the tree?
Well, it was a honey locust, and it was in an island that was created in a parking lot.
Okay.
I did see a flare. If I didn't do it, I didn't purposely. I just, the photo may not have it.
Okay, but you said you saw a flare.
Yes.
Root flare coming out of the ground.
Yes.
Now, here's the story, and there is still much debate about this. Does mistletoe attack weakened plants? In other words, they're easy prey for this parasite. Or does the mistletoe drop onto pretty much any tree at once and then saps the strength of the tree? So the consensus is that mistletoe will not harm a perfectly healthy tree. And it's up to you whether you want to remove it, display it, something like that. But definitely it goes after trees that are already weakened and sometimes already dead.
Would you inoculate a tree if you would? I mean, if you had a prize magnolia in your front yard, would you say, let me grow mistletoe on this tree?
No. You're just asking for trouble.
Okay.
No. If it shows up, it shows up. But it is generally, and my opinion is 100%, it shows up on stressed trees. And come on, what trees suffer worse stress than in those narrow strips in shopping centers?
You're 100% right.
And especially this year when those trees in our Pennsylvania area have gone totally unwatered for 5 or 6 weeks. And as we are taping this show, almost all parts of Pennsylvania have a deficit of like a foot. We have zero water. Matter of fact, something I've been looking for a reason to mention on the show is grab the first cranberries you can from Jersey, because most of the harvest was lost. There was no water to flood the bogs. The berries desiccated from lack of just generic water. So this is climate change on a stick. We are making it more and more difficult for, quote, normal plants to survive, which I know this isn't all popular, but this is one reason I beg people not to go nuts over tearing up live plants to install native plants, because the native plants may have thrived back when we lived in a normal climate, but we appear to be approaching like the end of a bad science fiction novel here, and the plants are so stressed, and the mistletoe is definitely a sign of that stress. Mm-hmm. Now, is the shopping center open on Sunday?
Yes, it is.
Ah, damn. I was thinking if you had a 12-gauge, you could go make some extra money.
They should put a sign underneath it, you know, $5 kisses.
Yeah, you know, no, you can't do anything like that in today's society. but it would be cool if you caught somebody under it and pointed up to it and see what their reaction is. They probably
you do that.
they probably pull a gun on you.
Yeah.
All
well,
right,
thank you, Mike.
Fascinating.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everyone once again that You Bet Your Garden will move to a new home beginning in June. So please email us your questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at YBYG, for You Bet Your Garden, at ptd.net. Our new web address will be youbetyourgarden.org, and you'll find out lots more info at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Check it every day for exciting updates. I'm Mike McGrath, and the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden will be our finale here on WDIY and NPR. Be sure to tune in to laugh, cry, and find out where to find our new podcast in June. Plus, a new talk with our favorite naturalist, Thor Hansen, live music, and much more. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden. From the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA, I am your host, Mike McGrath. And yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. I promise you will be fascinated as I explain the caterpillar look-alike that has nothing to do with caterpillars. And despite its name, it's not a fly. It is a weird one. And it behooves you to know what it looks like, acts like, and how to get rid of it easily. And we'll do that after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls.
My name is Rose, and I live in the Ozarks here in Missouri. And a comment is about the wireless deer detractor. We're right in the middle of deer country here. And there is a law in Missouri that you cannot put a deer attractant anywhere on your property. It's also my deer. They go, you have to go through all sorts of hideous things like tangling thorn covered briars, barbed wire fences, and you name it. And I don't think that a poke in their nose would make that much difference to them. I don't know. I haven't tried it, but what I use is an animal stopper, and essentially it smells like dead meat. So I thought that might help. Love your show. Bye.
Well, I can understand the law, because hunters will often try to lure deer to a specific area where they have a tree stand set up. And I believe that is illegal in many states. And, you know, for good reason. I mean, it's just unfair. You're not really hunting. You're like shooting metal ducks at a carnival or something. What you're referring to is called the wireless deer fence. And again, you look it up online, wireless deer fence. You get three stakes with electrodes on the top and scent pellets that you use to attract the deer to the electrodes on the top. They get a mild shock and run away. Now, I have to tell you, I mean, you're not piling up a huge amount of corn in a field and then picking them off. So I don't think the law was meant for this, but I think it's worthwhile. The animal repellent you mentioned is probably made from rotten eggs, essentially. And it is very effective at keeping deer and other herbivores away. But as you know, you have to reapply it after rains. It loses its effectiveness. So my solution is the motion-activated sprinkler. I mean, you have a long season there. You could have this thing hooked up for all the growing season before you get a freeze. And it's very simple. I mean, you'll find a lot of them online, motion-activated sprinkler. It senses, it has a motion activator in the head of this device. And then you can either have a short stake that puts it in the ground, or I went for a big tripod that holds it above everything because it's much more effective. And when the motion detector detects something as big as a deer, for God's sake, it shoots a couple of cups of cold water at them, and they run away. I use both. I have a motion-activated sprinkler to protect my garden, but I have hostas, beds of hostas, all throughout the rest of my property, and the last 2 years, the deer have eaten them before they can flower. So this year, I went ballistic. Took all of the wireless deer fence stakes I had, which was a dozen, made sure there were fresh batteries in them, made sure they had fresh attractor pellets, and surrounded the hostas, which is deer's favorite food, with them. And so far, I shouldn't be saying this, should I? I should wait until the flowers are done. But so far, the stalks of the hostas are untouched, and I see the purple flowers beginning to emerge. So you're welcome to keep using your repellent. There's no law against using the motion-activated sprinkler. Okay? Good luck to you. All right, as promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling sawflies, a truly weird garden pest. I was looking around for an unusual topic we hadn't covered for a while, and I found one that also solves a mystery many of you may be confronted with this season. So from a couple of years back, we represent what I learned about what might be the strangest garden pest of all time. Nancy in Forks Township, PA, called into the show and left a message on our answering machine about sawflies on her hibiscus plants. Sawflies, possibly the strangest insect pest out there are a topic that doesn't come up often, and we haven't discussed them in quite a while. Although they look exactly like extremely creepy caterpillars, sawfly larvae do not become moths or butterflies, nor do they turn into any kind of actual fly, as their name suggests. I now quote from the Missouri Botanical Gardens' excellent website. Sawflies are in the same order as ants, wasps, and bees. Their name derives from the adult female's abdominal appendage, which she uses to insert eggs in foliage. Adult sawflies have two pair of wings and are dark, wasp-like, somewhat flattened insects, usually a half inch long or shorter. Most of the surface feeding larvae, the caterpillar lookalikes, have six or more pairs of prolegs on the abdomen and one large, quote, eye on each side of the head. An exception is the pear sawfly, whose larvae resemble a small, dark olive green slug. McGrath here. It is difficult to adequately describe the caterpillar-like larvae, many of which are yellow with black dots, look like refugees from a horror movie, and tend to appear in large clusters, which makes them even creepier. But despite their uncanny resemblance, they are not caterpillars of any kind. And so the ancient, trusted, organic caterpillar killer, Bacillus thuringiensis, aka the old original BT, has no effect on them. And no shame on those who have tried. It's the first thing I would have done. And there isn't just one kind of sawfly. Quote, the bristly rose slug is, as the name implies, a slug-like sawfly larva, one of several types that feed on roses. It is shiny black to pale green. When it reaches maturity, it develops bristle-like hairs on its body, from which its name, bristly, is derived. Young larvae skeletonize the lower leaf surfaces of their favorite host, while mature larvae chew large holes in the leaves. The good news is that sawflies generally don't do much damage, and ignoring them is one option. And as those of you who have listened to this show for years realize, ignoring things going wrong in the garden is my favorite option. I just wait for the predators to get to work. Furthermore, the Botanic Garden site continues, a number of natural enemies keep most sawfly populations low, including parasitic mini wasps, birds, small mammals, and predaceous beetles, as well as fungal and viral diseases. McGrath here again. Organic gardeners should always remember that what's a pest to you is a big, delicious bag of protein to a predator, especially in this case, birds. Side note, when a single nest of tent caterpillars appeared in my crab apple tree one spring, I told my assistant, the awesome Ninja Sean, to just poke at it with the longest handled hoe we had and make a tear in it. And then what, he asked. That's it, I told him, we're done. The birds will take it from here. And the next day, there was not a single caterpillar left. Birds are a gardener's best friend. But to get them to work for you, you must not feed them bird seed. They'll fill up on the seed and leave your pests alone. And you have to realize that bird feeders are not good for the birds either. For many reasons, including and especially the spreading of disease due to the unnatural crowding that feeders cause. Feeders are 100% for human amusement only. The birds do not need them. They have been existing on pests like sawflies since sawflies were there for them to eat. And they will continue to do so if you stop filling them up with junk food. If you really want to lean into attracting flying friends to your garden, have lots of bird baths around your plants. Birds don't need human-supplied food in the summer, but fresh water can be scarce at times, especially now that droughts are becoming much more common. Give the birds lots of fresh water to drink and bathe in, and they'll return the favor by eating your pest insects. It's in their DNA. It's what they do. Don't believe me? The Missouri Botanic Garden notes that a few sawfly larvae on a large or mature plant may do little damage and can be tolerated. And when larvae become half grown or larger, they actually eat less. Leaving those larvae alone for birds to manage naturally could be a good and beneficial solution. Sawflies feeding mid to late summer even do less harm. Other simple solutions include hand-picking the little monsters. They don't sting like some venomous caterpillars. And the classic, spraying them off your plants with laser-sharp streams of water, which I have come to realize is the single most misquoted and misunderstood of my organic suggestions. We're talking about sharp streams of water, not gentle sprays, not mists. You need an adjustable nozzle that has a laser sharp setting. If you don't see the pests go flying off the plant when you spray it, the spray is not sharp enough. If you have lousy water pressure, you can buy an inexpensive nozzle attachment that funnels even a weak flow through a smaller diameter tube to create a powerful force. You can also just prune off any affected plant parts, trash them, and go home early, unless you have chickens, and then you should feed them to the chickens. And finally, if spray something you must, oh yeah, I know who you are, you can smother them with professionally made insecticidal soap or a horticultural oil designed for use in the summer, not dormant oil. That's only for use on fruit trees over the winter. Well, that sure was some good information about identifying and eliminating this seriously weird sawfly. Now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read that article over at your leisure or your leisure. Just click the link for the question of the week at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page, or go directly to our new website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes. My producer is threatening to saw my flies if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can and should send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at our new email address, ybyg@ptd.com. Net. Please include your location. You'll find all of this contact information, plus answers to your garden questions, audio of this show, audio of recent shows, links to our internationally renowned podcast, and important information about our next menu. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is an hour-long public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you weekly by NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he sat too close to an early television set that showered him with cosmic rays while he was watching The Three Stooges on Popeye Theater with Sally Starr. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we are about to enter a miserable, hot and muggy early heat wave. So I'll just keep my lettuce watered and in as much shade as I can provide until I see you again right here next week.